I read this article a couple of days ago, and I found it fascinating. First of all, as Richard explained a little earlier, I mean, the numbers in North America are clear. The numbers in the UK and elsewhere are clear. As Richard says, this isn't an economic virus in some ways as much as anything else. But what I found interesting is there seems to be, I don't know, John, if I'd say it's more of a willingness of black and minority ethnic athletes to talk out, to speak out in the UK about their concerns. Maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it's because the UK has been, you know, right now is, I mean, it's been hit hard and it's currently trying to struggle with coming out of this. But I've been surprised that we haven't heard that sort of that similar discussion from athletes in North America. Does that surprise you a bit?
Yeah, it does. I especially because when you think of, I don't really think the term athlete activism, I think it's athletes doing exactly what they're supposed to do, speaking out on issues that affect their friends, families, and fans. But that is something that North American athletes have been supremely vocal about, for issues that I would think would be considerably more contentious than whether or not a game should be played, things like Black Lives Matter and others. So I think it is a little surprising that we haven't heard from people, but I also think that although I don't think the data clarity in this country is really good, there are other sources for your information. The NHS is a pretty trusted source of information, so people are able to get some data. And I think we're more aware of that here, perhaps, than some of the people in the States, especially, who are struggling with whether they should inject bleach or not.
Yeah, well, that is at one end of the spectrum, for sure. You know, although the conversation around the demographics of those affected, and I say in places like Detroit, certainly has been that certainly has been a discussion point here, John. So it's not like people are completely oblivious to it.
No. I think I was listening a little bit to the conversation before I came on. I think one of the problems with when you talk about athletes speaking up on these things is that professional athletes are broadly the least sympathetic figures when it comes to the financial impact of anything. And so when you hear people talking about not wanting to play, and I think we have to be really careful with our language, it is not that athletes don't want to play. It's that certain athletes are aware that their chance of dying is higher. And so actually it's athletes don't want to die. And even if they're in the peak of physical shape and would manage to sail through a COVID infection, they don't want to put the rest of their family at risk. And then one of the other things that we have to bear in mind here is you saw those stats, right? It's about, right now, the latest ONS, the Office of National Statistics in the UK, they're talking about 4.2 times more likely to die from a COVID-related death if you're a black man, and about 4.3 times more likely if you're a black woman. Now, I think I've heard some of you talk about the comorbidities, the other things that might be at play that are associated with certain types of races. And I just need to tell you that this data has been adjusted for region, urban or rural location, deprivation, household composition, socioeconomic position, highest qualification held, and I think, general health and disability. We have adjusted the data for all of those, and you are still twice as likely to die when you adjust for those things, if you are black than white. So this is not a figment of imagination.
So are you suggesting that, I know you're not suggesting, you just give me data, John, but would that suggest then some kind of a direct genetic component in terms of the way it affects one population for another, or is that still possibly about outbreaks in certain areas that might be socioeconomically related in terms of people? Using public transit and all that.
Exactly. So there are some people who will be, perhaps you could say they're overrepresented in public facing or key worker roles, so that they are more exposed. But then we've looked also at that as part of the data. And I say we, it's other good scientists, not me, have looked at the data, and that's not the case. But what we do know, for example, in the UK, we know maternal mortality, even before COVID, you are five times more likely for a black woman to die in childbirth than a white woman. And we know that when we adjust the data for all those factors that I talked about, it still happens. And one of the factors that we figured out, and this really, you know, shouldn't be a great clanging bell for people, is that racism is at play. Because what we found is that when a white woman says, you get asked the pain question, for example, where's your pain between a 1 and 10? 1 is nothing, 10 is the worst pain you've ever experienced. Where are you? When a white woman says 7, they believe it's 7. And when a black woman says 7, they think it's a 4 because black women are strong and they can take it. And that leads to an inequity of care. And it's not, I know that sounds like a terrible damnation of all nurses and doctors, and that's not what I'm saying. It's a kind of bias that lives inside people without them even sometimes knowing about it. It's the kind of thing that makes people cross the road when they see a certain person coming, even though they know they're not that kind of person. So we can't take away these sociological factors before we go straight to genetics, because the truth is that we are not a genetically different race. Mm-hmm. It is, race is a social construct. It is not a genetic construct. Mm-hmm.
John, one of the things that always strikes me, quite frankly pisses me off, I'll just be blunt, is the what I feel too often is a reflexive nature of many sports fans. I'm not going to generalize anybody, but many sports fans to side with owners over players reflexively, side with billionaires over millionaires. And I think we've seen a little bit of this in the States here. I'd be curious, obviously, your take on what's going on in the UK. But some of the athletes who in the United States who have sort of made it a point to say, you know, I'm not satisfied with this kind of salary for this, or I'm not really going to give back money, even if it's for the greater good of getting the game back and providing this this entertainment for the masses. And I'm wondering, as someone obviously who played at the highest levels of professional basketball, do you have any thoughts as to why that is? I don't want to put a race component in it, but I'm also not naive, and I also know the world of professional sports owners for the most part is white, and in certain sports the base of players who play is African American. So I'm wondering just your thoughts as somebody who is on the literally on the arena of this, who saw reflexively how often ownership is generally speaking sort of supported more in these disputes between owners and players.
It is remarkable, but sometimes I think in the juxtaposition of owner versus player, it actually can appear that the owner is the more normal person, the more average Joe. You know what I mean? It can appear that this billionaire, who's actually significantly more wealthy than any of the players or all of them added up, can seem in a conversation between the two to be the most ordinary and down-to-earth, the one you could have a beer with. And that I think that false commonality makes people want to side with that. But I also think that people, the context of sport is very different than most people's workplaces, and most people recognize that when they go into their manager's office after a year of great work and they say, I think I should have a pay rise, and they're aware of the context of how well the workplace is doing or not, they don't think of that as greed. But when it's an athlete, lots of people have this idea that I wish I could be doing that, and or the thing I got yelled at me often was that you know, I'd do it for free. How dare you? And it's like, you wouldn't, because it's your job. And the other thing I heard a lot from people, and not always directed at me, frankly, because I was not good enough to attract that much ire, but from the sidelines, you'd hear people say, you should be grateful. And I always think that's such an incredibly telling phrase, because it means that you have no concept. Forget the idea of these narratives of you know, coming from the hood to the league. That's not it. You've no idea the number of hours of dull, repetitive, painful work that's gone in to get to that point. Grateful is nothing to do with it. I should be grateful that I had willpower, is what is the truth. But I think when you add those things together, you can see why, as I mentioned at the beginning, the athlete as a figure, not forget who the individual is, and I think you could well lay a race on top of that as well, frankly, but the athlete as a figure is just not hugely sympathetic.
John, I'm wondering, I referred earlier to the story about N'Golo Kanté of Chelsea. Mm-hmm. You know, we've heard there. Mike Trout has expressed reluctance, baseball players expressed reluctance to come back because his wife is expecting their first child. And she said, I'm going to be there. And, you know, how are organizations in particular sports organizations, John, going to have to adapt to the idea that, you know, when we hear a player saying, I don't want to play, a lot of times we think, well, he's greedy, you know, he's holding out for another contract, whatever. How are organizations going to have to adapt to handling to a guy who, or woman, who just has legitimate health concerns about this, just not comfortable? That's, I mean, that's going to put a little bit of it's going to create some changes, isn't it, for sort of hard-bitten general managers or coaches to deal with that?
Yeah, it will. But in fairness, hard-bitten general managers and coaches need to evolve anyway. But I would suggest that the position here is quite complicated, because actually many athletes' insurance could be null and void if they operate in an environment that can reasonably be seen to put their life at risk. So that automatically puts a new spin on things. And the guidance is so wishy-washy. I don't know what's happening in Canada, frankly, but I can only imagine it's better than what's happening here in terms of the information. But the guidance is so esoteric here. Stay alert is what we've been told lately, as if the virus is can be personified, and perhaps if we all look out, we might be able to swat it like a fly. And that makes it really difficult for people to make good choices about what they need to do. And the truth is, right now, what we need to do is stay home, because herd immunity means killing hundreds of thousands of people, and we just need to know that. And I've got to tell you, in the game of life, with the scales weighing, the death of 100,000 strangers versus my need to watch an NBA basketball game, I don't know what kind of person allows the scales to fall on the side of Saturday afternoon entertainment.
Well, look, I'm not going to disagree with you about the relative importance of professional sport, but in a context of an economy that, for better or for worse, is reopening, and people are going back to work, John, in all kinds of areas, not just professional sport. So people are being asked, requested, told to come back to work in factories, in offices, in grocery stores, in restaurants, eventually, in all kinds of places. Do you think athletes in that context, do you imagine many professional athletes opting out? If, you know, and again, I understand they may not have that option in some cases. There may be different reasons for it, you know, medical, lack of economic pressure, all kinds of things. But, you know, because that's the context we're operating in here, not if, you know, playing games is silly in the context of
I'm not saying it's silly, but I just think death. How many? So let me frame it this way: 470 odd players in the Premiership. I don't know how many are in the NBA at this current point. But how many of 500 people is the number we're willing to risk to watch the games? And how about this? If it's not any of that 500, but it's only a stranger who we don't know, one of their children, one of their grandparents, how many bodies is enough? Because I think you're absolutely right. Very few people, very few athletes have the power to say no. So very few will. They will not risk their career in a post-COVID world. But what they don't realize is that we don't know if there's a post-COVID world yet. Because we don't know if this is seasonal or not. We don't know if a virus will be effective. We don't know that if getting the virus makes you immune to the virus. And if it does, we don't know how long that works for. So when you look at this in this context, this isn't talking about the next 6 months. This is talking about the next 6 years. And for me, I always look at athletes and think, we have to think of them, and this will sound patronizing, but I don't mean it that way, as vulnerable adults. In the UK, there's this designation of certain types of people, often with intellectual difficulties, who are vulnerable adults because they can't make decisions necessarily on their own behalf. But athletes aren't vulnerable because they're intellectually inferior. They're vulnerable because they know that, you know, when people say, your boss will have said to your listeners right now, their boss will have said to them at some point, can I go home an hour early? I've got to pick up my kids. And the boss will have said to them something along the order of, do what you want. Yeah, it's totally up to you. And you'll look in their face and you'll know it means if you do this, there'll be consequences. And so you don't go. And that kind of position, to have 500 people willing to risk their life because they're afraid to lose their job, to me, the moral equation of that is off kilter.
John, in the United States, the decision to go watch a sporting event in the next couple of months is being played out on political lines. You mm-hmm. see in particular states that are very supportive of the current president, and states that would be sort of leaning more right than left, there's almost a determination that, damn, I'm going back to my sporting event. I'm going to show up. No one's going to tell me what I should do. We're seeing that played out, or we may see that played out in college athletics, which, you know, that we could do an hour discussion on college athletes being put back into this arena with literally no payment.
And they're really vulnerable adults.
Yeah, and they're exactly. So here's the reason I sort of set that up. Thankfully, Canada is different. I don't feel like the return to the crowd element is being played on political lines. Mm-hmm. Could you give us a sense of how it is in where you are in the UK? Because especially in the world of professional football, soccer, so much identity and so much culture is wrapped around these teams in these cities and in these towns.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Even within, I live in central London, and it's really bizarre because, you know, in the before times, when football games were going on, you would hear the roar on my terrace. I'd hear the roar from one side, and then the roar from another side of London, because there are what feels like 16 teams in London, and there's a beautiful tension here that I really think speaks to the best of humanity, which is the idea that so many football fans are desperate, and rightly so. Liverpool fans, for example, who I fear will be cheated out of something remarkable, and for me to even know that tells you how important that is in the zeitgeist of the Britain, because I haven't been to a football game since 1976. So there's so many of them who are so keen to get back, and so many of them who will not risk it, and that I think is the beautiful tension. The idea, get it on television if you need to. Right now, most of the TV stations are showing old games, and people are getting unduly excited about matches that they already know the outcome of. And I think there's something in that that is so generous. But all I would say to those people who are being politicized about this is that I recognize that even amongst... I love coming on your show, but I always recognize that people think I'm too geeky and weird and the package is wrong. And many people will know my political views and not like me for that. But just let me say this. I don't care whether you're a person who likes me or hates me, whether you think that I'm off the wall. I am begging you, do not go. Because I don't care your political persuasion, I'd like you to be alive to vote next time. And if you must go, wear a mask. It's not tyranny. It's trying to save your life, and it's the most generous thing you can do for the strangers around you.
John, we've got you for another couple of minutes here, and I just want to return to one, and understanding where you come from, absolutely. And I think we kind of come from the same place. But when we're talking about kind of athletes' rights, the rights of professional athletes, and the concerns in terms of going back to their job, and versus the rights of, you know, other workers, because how they're not, you know, do you they are going to have the best of medical care, they're going to be tested more diligently and regularly than people in the regular population. You know, the worst outbreaks we've had in this continent have been in meatpacking plants, where people are working shoulder to shoulder for terrible wages and are being asked to go right back in after the outbreaks. That's not the life of a professional athlete. I wonder, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about whether they should play or they shouldn't play, but isn't there, you know, is it fair to separate that from the discussion about workers going back? You know, and again,
no, absolutely.
I know there is, we can separate essential from non-essential, but some of that's pretty arbitrary.
Yeah, I would make the separation from essential to non-essential. That's what I'd make. And I don't think that whilst some of it feels arbitrary, I think some of it isn't. I think we've suddenly learned that there's a whole group of people that we have basically been blind to, invisible as they walk past us, as they drive our buses and tubes and trams, and they've been invisible to us. And now we suddenly realize they have a new name, and that name is key, because they are key workers. And I just don't know how you extend that to athletes, no matter what they're being paid. And I do recognize that, yes, they've got the best of care, but if you adjust for all the different things, including socioeconomic status, which comes along with your medical care level, you're still two times more likely to die if you're black. And I don't know how many people in workplaces, do you think that athletes are going to wear masks when they play? I can't tell you the number of times, and this is slightly gross, that I've been on a court, I mean, it's almost in a game, per game, where you're on a court and somebody does a spin move, somebody runs for a ball, and their sweat is in your mouth. The number of times when you're in tight situations and their breath is in the nape of your neck. I just don't think that this is the kind of risk, and the tests are not infallible. You must know that. The tests are not infallible. If they were, we might be able to have a different conversation, but they're not infallible. 3 out of 10 is a false positive. Three out of 100 is a false positive. And at this point, for this many people, for 500 people in a league, that could lead to a lot of danger. Plus, the athletes aren't just around each other. They're around security. They're around receptionists. They're around any number of people on a daily basis. We've got to be really careful with everybody, and I don't think athletes are special in that care. I think the return to work should be careful and paced, and if you can't provide adequate health security for your people, we've really got to question whether they should go back if they're not key.
John, listen, it was really good of you to join us today. Thanks so much. Always thought-provoking. And stay safe. We wish you all the best. And we'll be chatting again when we come out on the other side of this, whenever it is.
To you and your listeners as well. Thank you.